You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the September 2018 issue of Vanity Fair magazine, and moving on to October 2018, if time allows. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Today's broadcast is in memory of those who died in Hurricane Florence. The broadcast is also dedicated to Governor Roy Cooper and all the agencies he has coordinated to help our state get through this incredible storm. Thank you to the many law enforcement officers, the emergency management personnel, fire department personnel, streets maintenance employees, the media for keeping us up to date on warnings, flood warnings, weather warnings, road closings, and all sorts of other information that the media gave us. Thank you to the number of power company employees working so hard to restore power to this state. There are too many people to even imagine laboring right now, too many to name. But thank you to all of you, the people who are selflessly giving of their time, whether being paid or volunteering. Those of you who came from other states to help us, Fire Department of New York, the Swiftwater Rescue Teams, the search dog teams from California who came here, the power company employees who came here. Again, too many to name, but thank you so much to all of you. It'll take a while for us to get through this. We'll all have to pull together. And we can do it. Help your neighbor. Here's the continuation of The Unforgiven by Maureen Orth. Today, Karina's life is a waiting game. She has served the maximum 8 years called for under her demobilization, and the government cleared her for release last October. But it has not let her go, according to General Montoya, for fear that she'd be a walking target, especially for the FARC. "She gave us so much," he says. Karina mentions that she and a prominent former paramilitary leader have discussed teaming up to become models of forgiveness and cooperation. "Yet right now, I do not have the government's support and have never had it." Prosecutors who have seen Karina face her victims and their families countless times in court over the years believe her repentance is genuine. But many Colombians still despise the FARC. Although violence in Colombia has fallen dramatically since the peace deal, the accord remains unpopular in parts of this intensely polarized country. Perhaps its most hated provision is the one guaranteeing the FARC 10 seats in Congress, even though the party received less than 0.3% of the vote in last March's congressional elections. Virtually all of those with guaranteed seats have been accused of war crimes. But the system to try them has been delayed in Congress and tied up in red tape. Meanwhile, Colombia has more acres of coca under cultivation than at any time in the last 2 decades. And excess acreage is just what the FARC's 1,500 dissidents want. They refuse to give up their arms, and many are thought to be back in the drug business. Growers, meanwhile, have been eagerly planting coca so they can collect crop substitution subsidies. As high-status FARC members take their seats in Congress, the rank and file are struggling. Plans to look after demobilized guerrillas in zones of concentration are falling apart owing to government ineptitude. Shockingly, more than 120 activists working to help administer programs such as crop substitution have been murdered this year. I know the Colombian people need a country in peace, Karina says, but the government did not need to give them 10 seats in Congress right away. The FARC should have had to win their seats. She also objects to the occupants of those seats, who have yet to face any truth and reconciliation. The same old people have always wanted the power. They had all the power inside the FARC, and they want the same here. Karina believes the FARC is still hiding substantial amounts of money from the authorities, though the group denies it, and she feels that its leaders have profited off the suffering of their followers. While they are well off, those below them are in terrible conditions, she says. If the FARC's objective really was to create a more egalitarian society, it failed. 55 years later, Colombia remains one of the most unequal countries in the world. Having been a national symbol of fear and hatred, Karina says she would welcome the chance to serve as a beacon of reconciliation. My plan is to get out and keep working for the communities, especially for those victims of the war who were directly or indirectly victims of mine, she says. I am truly repentant for what I did. Although she speaks to her daughter and other relatives regularly on the phone, it is difficult to form real ties after being cut off for so long, first in the jungle and then in jail. What Karina most longs for today is to be part of a real family. The only thing I want to do is get out of here and live a tranquil life, she says, a life reconciled with God and the victims. But before Elda can get her wish, Colombia must decide whether it can forgive Karina. Growing Up Jobs. Steve Jobs and Chris Ann Brennan were 23 when their daughter was born. Lisa Brennan Jobs remembers the pride and pain of a childhood spent navigating the vastness between her struggling single mom and Apple's mercurial founder. Opening photo, the namesake, Lisa Brennan Jobs on her father's lap in the Palo Alto home she shared with her mother, 1987. This article is adapted from Small Fry, a memoir, by Lisa Brennan Jobs, to be published September 4, 2018, by Grove Press. Copyright 2018 by the author. 3 months before he died, I began to steal things from my father's house. I wandered around barefoot and slipped objects into my pockets. I took blush, toothpaste, 2 chipped finger bowls in celadon blue, a bottle of nail polish, a pair of worn patent leather ballet slippers, and 4 faded white pillowcases, the color of old teeth. After stealing each item, I felt sated. I promised myself that this would be the last time, but soon the urge to take something else would arrive again, like thirst. I tiptoed into my father's room, careful to step over the creaky floorboard at the entrance. This room had been his study, when he could still climb the stairs. But he slept here now. He was propped up in bed, wearing shorts. His legs were bare and thin as arms, bent up like a grasshopper's. "Hey, Lise," he said. Segyo Rinpoche stood beside him. He'd been around recently when I came to visit. A short Brazilian man with sparkling brown eyes. The Rinpoche was a Buddhist monk with a scratchy voice who wore brown robes over a round belly. We called him by his title. Near us, a black canvas bag of nutrients hummed with a motor and a pump, the tube disappearing somewhere under my father's sheets. "It's a good idea to touch his feet," Rinpoche said, putting his hands around my father's foot on the bed. "Like this." I didn't know if the foot touching was supposed to be for my father, or for me, or for both of us. "Okay," I said, and took his other foot in its thick sock. Even though it was strange watching my father's face, because when he winced in pain or anger, it looked similar to when he started to smile. "That feels good," my father said, closing his eyes. I glanced at the chest of drawers beside him and at the shelves on the other side of the room for objects I wanted, even though I knew I wouldn't dare steal something right in front of him. While he slept, I wandered through the house, looking for I didn't know what. The house was quiet, the sounds muffled. The terracotta floor was cool on my feet, except in the places where the sun had warmed it to the temperature of skin. In the cabinet of the half-bath near the kitchen, where there used to be a tattered copy of the Bhagavad Gita, I found a bottle of expensive rose facial mist. With the door closed, the light out, sitting on the toilet seat, I sprayed it up into the air and closed my eyes. The mist fell around me, cool and holy, as in a forest or an old stone church. Later, I would put everything back. But now, avoiding the housekeeper, my brother and sisters, and my stepmother around the house so I wouldn't be caught stealing things, or hurt when they didn't acknowledge me or reply to my hellos, and spraying myself in the darkened bathroom to feel less like I was disappearing. Because inside the falling mist, I had a sense of having an outline again, making efforts to see my sick father in his room began to feel like a burden, a nuisance. For the past year, I'd visited for a weekend every other month or so. I'd given up on the possibility of a grand reconciliation, the kind in the movies, but I kept coming anyway. Before I said goodbye, I went to the bathroom to mist one more time. The spray was natural, which meant that over the course of a few minutes it no longer smelled sharp like roses, but fetid and stinky like a swamp, although I didn't realize it at the time. As I came into his room, he was getting into a standing position. I watched him gather both his legs in one arm, twist himself 90 degrees by pushing against the headboard with the other arm, and then use both arms to hoist his own legs over the edge of the bed and onto the floor. When we hugged, I could feel his vertebrae, his ribs. He smelled musty, like medicine sweat. "I'll be back soon," I said. We detached, and I started walking away. "Lise?"
"Yeah?"
"You smell like a toilet." Next, photos, far from the tree. Lisa with her mother in Saratoga, California, 1981. And Lisa with her father 3 days after she was born, 1978. In the spring of 1978, when my parents were 23, my mother gave birth to me on their friend Robert's farm in Oregon with the help of two midwives. The labor and delivery took 3 hours, start to finish. My father arrived a few days later. "It's not my kid," he kept telling everyone at the farm, but he'd flown there to meet me anyway. I had black hair and a big nose, and Robert said, "She sure looks like you." My parents took me out into a field, laid me on a blanket, and looked through the pages of a baby name book. He wanted to name me Claire. They went through several names, but couldn't agree. They didn't want something derivative, a shorter version of a longer name. "What about Lisa?" my mother finally said. "Yes, that one," he said happily. He left the next day. "Isn't Lisa short for Elizabeth?" I asked my mother. "No, we looked it up. It's a separate name." "And why did you let him help name me when he was pretending he wasn't the father?" "Because he was your father," she said. During the time my mother was pregnant, my father started work on a computer that would later be called the Lisa. It was the precursor to the Macintosh, the first mass-market computer with an external mouse, the mouse as large as a block of cheese. But it was too expensive, a commercial failure. My father began on the team working for it, but then started working against it, competing against it on the Mac team. The Lisa computer was discontinued, the 3,000 unsold computers later buried in a landfill in Logan, Utah. Until I was 2, my mother supplemented her welfare payments by cleaning houses and waitressing. My father didn't help. She found babysitting at a daycare center inside a church run by the minister's wife, and for a few months we lived in a room in a house that my mother had found on a notice board meant for women considering adoption. Then, in 1980, the district attorney of San Mateo County, California, sued my father for child support payments. My father responded by denying paternity, swearing in a deposition that he was sterile, and naming another man he said was my father. I was required to take a DNA test. The tests were new then, and when the results came back, they gave the odds that we were related as the highest the instruments could measure at the time, 94.4%. The court required my father to cover welfare back payments, child support payments of $385 per month, which he increased to $500, and medical insurance until I was 18. The case was finalized on December 8, 1980, with my father's lawyers insistent to close. 4 days later, Apple went public, and overnight, my father was worth more than $200 million. But before that, just after the court case was finalized, my father came to visit me once at our house in Menlo Park, where we had rented a detached studio. It was the first time I'd seen him since I'd been a newborn in Oregon. "You know who I am?" he asked. He flipped his hair out of his eyes. I was 3 years old. I didn't. "I'm your father." Like he was Darth Vader, my mother said later when she told me the story. "I'm one of the most important people you will ever know," he said. By the time I was 7, my mother and I had moved 13 times. We rented spaces informally, staying in a friend's furnished bedroom here, a temporary sublet there. My father had started dropping by sometimes, about once a month, and he, my mother, and I would go roller skating around the neighborhood. His engine shuddered into our driveway, echoing off our house and the wooden fence on the other side, thickening the air with excitement. He drove a black Porsche convertible. When he stopped, the sound turned into a whine and then was extinguished, leaving the quiet more quiet, the pinpoint sounds of birds. I anticipated his arrival, wondering when it would happen, and thought about him afterward. But in his presence, for the hour or so we were all together, there was a strange blankness, like the air after his engine switched off. He didn't talk much. There were long pauses, the thunk and whir of roller skates on pavement. We skated the neighborhood streets. Trees overhead made patterns of the light. Fuchsia dangled from bushes and yards, stamens below a bell of petals, like women in ball gowns with purple shoes. My father and mother had the same skates, a beige nubuck body with red laces, crisscrossed over a double line of metal fast. As we passed bushes in other people's yards, he pulled clumps of leaves off the stems, then dropped the fragments as we skated, making a line of ripped leaves behind us on the pavement, like Hansel and Gretel. A few times, I felt his eyes on me. When I looked up, he looked away. After he left, we talked about him. "Why do his jeans have holes all over?" I asked my mother. "He might have sewn them up. I knew he was supposed to have millions of dollars." We didn't just say millionaire, but multi-millionaire when we spoke of him, because it was accurate, and because knowing the granular details made us part of it. She said my father had a lisp. "It's something to do with his teeth," she said. "They hit each other exactly straight on, and over the years they cracked and chipped where they hit, so the top and bottom teeth meet with no spaces. It looks like a zigzag or a zipper." "And he has these strangely flat palms," she said. I assigned mystical qualities to his zipper teeth, his tattered jeans, his flat palms, as if these were not only different from other fathers, but better. And now that he was in my life, even if it was only once a month, I had not waited in vain. I would be better off than children who'd had fathers all along. "I heard when it gets a scratch, he buys a new one," I overheard my mother say to her boyfriend Ron. "A new what?" I ask. "Porsche. Couldn't he just paint over the scratch?" I ask. "Car paint doesn't work like that," Ron said to me. "You can't just paint over black with black. It wouldn't blend." There are thousands of different blacks. They'd have to repaint the whole thing. The next time my father came over, I wondered if it was the same car he'd been driving the last time, or if it was a new one that just looked the same. "I have a secret," I said to my new friends at school. I whispered it so that they would see I was reluctant to mention it. The key, I felt, was to underplay. "My father is Steve Jobs." "Who's that?" one asked. "He's famous," I said. "He invented the personal computer. He lives in a mansion and drives a Porsche convertible. He buys a new one every time it gets a scratch." The story had a film of unreality to it as I said it, even to my own ears. I hadn't hung out with him that much, only a few skates and visits. I didn't have the clothes or the bike someone with a father like this would have. "He even named a computer after me," I said to them. "What computer?" a girl asked. "The Lisa," I said. "A computer called the Lisa?" she said. "I never heard of it." It was ahead of its time. I used my mother's phrase, although I wasn't sure why it was ahead. I brought it up when I felt I needed to, waited as long as I could, and then let it burst forth. I don't remember feeling at a disadvantage with my friends who had fathers, only that there was at my fingertips another magical identity, an extra thing that started to itch and tingle when I felt small. And it was like pressure building inside me. And then I had to find a way to say it. One afternoon around this time, my father brought over a Macintosh computer. He pulled the box out of the back seat and carried it into my room and put it on the floor. "Let's see," he said, "how do we open it?" as if he didn't know. This made me doubt he was the inventor. He pulled the computer out of the box by a handle on the top and set it on the floor near the outlet on the wall. "I guess we plug this in." He held the cord loose like it was unfamiliar. He sat on the floor in front of it with his legs crossed. I sat on my knees beside him. He looked for the on switch, found it, and the machine came alive to reveal a picture of himself, a picture of itself in the center, smiling. He showed me how I could draw and save my drawings on the desktop once I was finished with them, and then he left. He didn't mention the other one, the Lisa. I worried that he had not really named a computer after me, that it was a mistake. Next photo, her father's daughter, the author, photographed at home in Brooklyn. For a long time, I hoped that if I played one role, my father would take the corresponding role. I would be the beloved daughter. He would be the indulgent father. I decided that if I acted like other daughters did, he would join in the lark. We'd pretend together, and in pretending we'd make it real. If I had observed him as he was, or admitted to myself what I saw, I would have known that he would not do this, and that a game of pretend would disgust him. Later that year, I would stay overnight at my father's house on several Wednesdays while my mother took college classes in San Francisco. On those nights, we ate dinner, took a hot tub outside, and watched old movies. During the car rides to his house, he didn't talk. "Can I have it when you're done?" I asked him one night, as we took a left at the leaning, crumbling white pillars that flanked the thin, bumpy road ending at his gate. I'd been thinking about it for a while, but had only just built up the courage to ask. "Can you have what?" he said. "This car." your Porsche. I wondered where he put the extras. I pictured them in a shiny black line at the back of his land. Absolutely not, he said, in such a sour, biting way that I knew I'd made a mistake. I understood that perhaps it wasn't true, the myth of the scratch. Maybe he didn't buy new ones. By that time, I knew he was not generous with money, or food, or words. The idea of the Porsches had seemed like one glorious exception. I wished I could take it back. We pulled up to the house, and he turned off the engine. Before I made a move to get out, he turned to face me. "You're not getting anything," he said. "You understand? Nothing. You're getting nothing." Did he mean about the car? Something else? Bigger? I didn't know. His voice hurt, sharp, in my chest. The light was cool in the car. A white light on the roof had lit up when the car turned off. Around us was dark. I had made a terrible mistake, and he'd recoiled. By then, the idea that he'd named the failed computer after me was woven in with my sense of self, even if he did not confirm it, and I used this story to bolster myself when, near him, I felt like nothing. I didn't care about computers. They were made of fixed metal parts and chips with glinting lines inside plastic cases. But I liked the idea that I was connected to him in this way. It would mean I'd been chosen and had a place, despite the fact that he was aloof or absent. It meant I was fastened to the earth and its machines. He was famous. He drove a Porsche. If the Lisa was named after me, I was a part of all that. I see now that we were at cross purposes. For him, I was a blot on a spectacular ascent, as our story did not fit with the narrative of greatness and virtue he might have wanted for himself. My existence ruined his streak. For me, it was the opposite. The closer I was to him, the less I would feel ashamed. He was part of the world, and he would accelerate me into the light. It might all have been a big misunderstanding, a missed connection. He'd simply forgotten to mention the computer was named after me. I was shaking with the need to set it right all at once, as if waiting for a person to arrive for their surprise party, to switch on the lights and yell out what I'd held in. "Hey, you know that computer, the Lisa? Was it named after me?" I ask many years later, when I was in high school, and splitting my time between my parents' houses. I tried to sound like I was curious, nothing more. If he would just give me this one thing. Nope. His voice was clipped, dismissive, like I was fishing for a compliment. Sorry, kid. When I was 27, my father invited me to join for a few days on a yacht trip that he, my stepmother, my siblings, and the babysitter were taking in the Mediterranean. He didn't usually invite me on vacations. I went for a long weekend. Off the coast of the south of France, my father said we were going to make a stop in the Alpes Maritimes to meet a friend for lunch. He wouldn't say who the friend was. We took a boat to the dock, where a van picked us up and drove us to a lunch at a villa in Aix. It turned out to be Bono's villa. He met us out front wearing jeans, a t-shirt, and the same sunglasses I'd seen him wearing in pictures and on album covers. He gave us an exuberant tour of his house, as if he couldn't quite believe it was his. The windows faced the Mediterranean, and the rooms were cluttered with children's things. In an empty, light-filled, octagonal room, he said, Gandhi had once slept. We had lunch on a large covered balcony overlooking the sea. Bono asked my father about the beginning of Apple. Did the team feel alive? Did they sense it was something big and they were going to change the world? My father said it did feel that way as they were making the Macintosh. And Bono said it was that way for him and the band, too. And wasn't it incredible that people in such disparate fields could have the same experience? Then Bono asked, So, was the Lisa computer named after her? There was a pause. I braced myself, prepared for his answer. My father hesitated, looked down at his plate for a long moment, and then back at Bono. Yeah, it was, he said. I sat up in my chair. I thought so, Bono said. Yep, my father said. I studied my father's face. What had changed? Why had he admitted it now, after all these years? Of course it was named after me, I thought then. His lie seemed preposterous now. I felt a new power that pulled my chest up. That's the first time he's said yes, I told Bono. Thank you for asking. As if famous people needed other famous people around to release their secrets. Photograph of the author in this article by Judy Rojak. Muse Without a Trace. 90 years ago, an enigmatic actress and model swept through Paris, transfixing Cocteau, Matisse, Chagall, and dozens of other modernist masters. Then, after 3 whirlwind years, she vanished. Brian Moynihan untangles the myth of Maria Lani. Opening photo, Maria Lani by Man Ray, a photographic study with the artist Crop Marks, 1930. And next, artwork by Kees van Dongen, Oil, on canvas, 1928. The actress and her impresario arrived in Paris in 1928. They claimed that she was already a prominent cinema star in Berlin or Prague. It was never quite clear where. But no one had seen or heard of her before, and she was not a striking beauty. They said they had come to France to make a film, The Woman of the Hundred Faces. She called herself Maria Lani, and she was to play the lead. He, Maximilian Abramovich, or Mac Ramo, or Maximilian Ilian, he used all 3 names at various times, was to be the producer and writer. He said that his scenario called for portraits of her by different artists, and that the portraits would come alive, bursting out of their frames and onto the screen, each with its own distinct character and plot line. It was the idea of a lifetime, and indeed their lives were devoted to it. The unknown actress would be immortalized in a string of paintings by the city's modernist masters, Matisse, Chagall, Braque, 20 and more of them. The duo's timing was exquisite. Paris in the 1920s was après-guerre, lucent, lively, a whirlpool of talent and ideas. It was tolerant and open and cheap, very cheap. It sucked in the gifted and the young as no city had before, even English-language writers. Fitzgerald, Hemingway, Joyce flourished. It also had the greatest concentration of artists on earth. The key to meeting them was Jean Cocteau, the extraordinary writer cum artist cum socialite at its heart. A sometime essayist for the American Vanity Fair, he knew them all. He was recovering from opium addiction, needed distraction, and was fascinated by the crossover between art and film. He was soon to make his own avant-garde movie, The Blood of a Poet. Lani asked him to paint her. "I rarely went out," Cocteau later wrote. "I never left my sick room. Maria Lani was no more than a name for me, as I was to her. I begged her to forgive me and to take herself to a real painter." She had come unbidden to see him. He was astonished. She had unpacked her atmosphere in my room as if it were a great steamer trunk. With ill grace, I sat her on a chair and myself on another, armed with a stylograph. She bewitched him. He sketched her and spread his wild enthusiasm for her project across the city. In less than 2 years, as Vanity Fair reported in a story in its December 1929 issue, Lani had sat for the most important, most expensive, and most dangerous painters in Paris. She was the improbable perfection of her sex, the first genius of Europe, has massed against this one objective, merely to claim for art the secret of Maria Lani's smile. A single canvas portrays the fleeting and enigmatic smile of Leonardo da Vinci's Mona Lisa, but in bronze, in clay, in oil, in gouache, urged on by Cocteau, no fewer than 51 artists recorded their impressions of Maria Lani. The sittings she endured in her quest, all the stairs she climbed to all the atelier, an admirer wrote, trembling at her work rate. Maria Lani, Maria Lani, Maria Lani, wrote the surrealist Giorgio De Chirico. He found the cry repeated through the night, agitating, like the sirens in a factory district. Their muse was not easy to portray. She did not pose in the normal sense. The modern supermodel is demonstrably herself. Her face is her fortune. The clothes, the background, the pyrotechnics of the photo shoot may change. The face is constant, instantly recognizable. Lani's beauty was in her presence and not in her looks. In stature, she is tiny, the great film and theater director Max Reinhardt said. Her eyes are rather luminous, her lips attractive. No more than that. But when she sat, she reversed the model's role. Lani became the artist, the creator of the image. The painter was merely the medium. Cocteau felt it. An unknown force paralyzes me as I draw, he wrote. Suddenly, scales fall from my eyes. Madame Lani fait mon portrait, meaning, in effect, she is painting me. Every time you take your eyes off her, he added, she changes. In turn, you see a young girl, a ravaged woman, a schoolboy, a cat, thin lips, fat lips, a slender neck, a Herculean neck, vanquished shoulders, broad shoulders, the eyes of a Chinese woman. He despaired. How do you expect me to draw her? Henri Matisse, too, felt that he had failed. Lani spent an afternoon in his studio. A church bell was ringing in the distance. Matisse was humming as he sketched. Then anger swept over him. What kind of creature are you? He demanded. There is something between you and me. I cannot find you. God doesn't want me to. He sketched her a dozen times. To Georges Rohe, she was a suffering martyr. But he fretted, too. Dissatisfied with his black oil and gouache portrait in 1928, he returned to her in 1929. Marc Chagall painted her with the Eiffel Tower traced in a plume of her hair. Her face was a cubist mask to Georges Braque. De Chirico has her faceless above a monumental body. She is fresh-faced but knowing for Francis Picabia, hesitant and open to André Durin. To Pierre Bonnard, she is a 20s girl in cloche hat and fur. In Chaim Soutane's study, the eyes are sad and vulnerable, and there is a strained slope to the shoulders. Man Ray, Vanity Fair's Paris portraitist, rendered her with camera and with ink. Among the sculptors, Charles Despieux cast her in bronze. She projected a stunning range of emotions. A whole career could be devoted to painting such a model, the artist and fashion designer Paul Poiret found. She is at once candor and deceit, purity, vice, love, hate, irony, suffering, and lastly, la femme. Other giants of the time depicted her as well, Leger, Dufay, Van Dongen, Kiesling, Fujita, and on and on. She more than met the demand of the supposed Abramovich scenario for the woman of the hundred faces. She varied the character in each portrait so well that a British newspaper called in Scotland Yard. An expert in penetrating disguises examined them. No human being, without the aid of a surgeon, he said, could so distort the features depicted in the paintings. But each one depicted the same woman, Maria Lani. Abramowitz and Lani soon had 51 portraits in their possession, enough for international exhibitions, let alone a motion picture. They began in November 1929 with the Brummer Gallery at 57th Street and Madison Avenue in New York City. Pictured here, Oil on Canvas, 1928, by Kees van Dongen. Oil on Canvas, 1928-29, by Francis Picabia. And by Georges Roy, Gouache, Watercolor, Pastel, and Brush, and India Ink on Paper, 1928. Is she beautiful? Time asks. Is she thin, fat, tropical, anemic, senile, kittenish, or reptilian? Last week, Manhattanites asked these questions about Maria Lani, French cinema actress. The New York Times found it astounding that in Roy's painting, the circumstance of a blot of black paint can resolve itself into tragedy so heroic that it becomes almost impersonal. The collection moved on to the Arts Club of Chicago, the Kunstkring in Rotterdam, the Alfred Flechtheim Gallery in Berlin, the Georges Bernheim in Paris, Leicester Square in London. The Maria Lani Group is apparently circling the globe, a New York Times writer reported at the end of 1930. An obscure actress, one journalist wrote, had outdone Cleopatra and Catherine de' Medici. All London is talking of her. Maria Lani was now an international phenomenon. The aura that so transfixed artists also charmed Paris hostesses. Lani and Abramowitz had the best invitations. They led the social columns. She was introduced to Coco Chanel. Fashion houses and parfumiers vied for her custom and advertised it. Then, in 1931, the pair disappeared, seemingly without a trace. As the years went by, a legend grew, later detailed in Jean-Paul Crespel's 1968 history of the period, La Folle Époque. In it, Lani was no actress, but a Czech secretary, une petite sténographe de Prague. Abramowitz was the mastermind of an elaborate fraud, luring with a fake film scenario, high-value artist. He landed them all, except for the ever-suspicious Pablo Picasso. Once they had the precious works, Crespel wrote, they put the Atlantic Ocean between them and their patsies, absconding to America with their valuable hoard and living off the proceeds. Cocteau eventually gave the legend credence in a diary entry. Abramowitz dreamed up the story that this inconnue, this nobody, was a celebrated German actress, he wrote. He begged us all to do her portrait. He exhausted us. Cocteau added bitterly that Lani was called the favorite model of the great painters. Triumph of an imposture. The idea persists. John Galliano devoted his 2011 spring and summer collection to Maria Lani, the heroic con artist. This article will be continued in the next installment, and this is the final article for the September 2018 edition. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman. During Hurricane Florence and the aftermath, please be safe. And please help your neighbor if you can.